I admire the fact that they are speaking up, they are banding together, they are making themselves known. But it doesn't take away the fact that many of them worry about themselves, worry about their parents. Because if they're undocumented, chances are their parents are undocumented.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health, and you're listening to Into the Fold. The Hawk Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about the foundation, our history, and our programs, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. Here at the Hawk Foundation, we recently announced a strategic shift from a focus on treatment of illness to prevention of illness and promotion of mental health at the community level. As part of this new strategy, we will work with communities throughout Texas to better support mental health, achieve health equity, and promote well-being. This builds on our history of promoting recovery, but takes it a step further. Another key element of our new strategy is our conviction that the potential for change is greater when we focus on marginalized populations. To do this, we need to understand the unique stressors and threats to well-being that those populations face. For first and second generation immigrants in Texas, one stressor looms large, and that is the threat of deportation. Our guest, Luis Zayas, is dean of UT Austin's School of Social Work. This is a return visit. In 2015, we interviewed him about his work examining the effects of deportation anxiety on the children of the undocumented. Now, in light of the harsher political climate around immigration at both the national and state levels, we're bringing this issue back to the forefront. We're here from his office at the School of Social Work. Dr. Zayas, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ike. Thanks for having me back again.
For the first interview we did back in 2015, we talked about a study that you co-authored that examined levels of anxiety and depression among the U.S.-born children of the undocumented, especially in light of the looming threat of deportation. For our listeners who are meeting you for the first time, can you give us an overview of your work in this area?
Well, Ike, we began to study the children, the U.S.-born citizen children of undocumented immigrants, about 5 years ago, 6 years ago now. And our concern was that these were U.S. citizens who were being affected early in life by the possible deportation or the actual deportation of their parents. So what our study did was we interviewed a group of children who are living in Mexico after their parents' deportation, and another group who had been left behind in the United States after their parents had been deported to Mexico. And to understand what the average condition, if you will, is for children of undocumented immigrants, we had a third group. These were U.S.-born citizen children whose parents are undocumented, but who were under no deportation proceedings. By structuring the study this way, we could then be able to make judgments and compare the two groups. And it was an interesting study. We found that the children who had left the U.S. for Mexico were experiencing a great disruption in their lives. They were no longer connected to the schools that they attended when they were here in the U.S. They were no longer in touch with their friends. They weren't enjoying the kind of educational and health care services that they had been accustomed to. The safety and security issues that we provide in this country, where a child can ride their bike up and down the street without the worry of gangs and violence in general. The children in Mexico were often depressed and had a hard time adjusting. They were considered not fully Mexican by the Mexican children there because they did not speak Spanish quite the way the children did there, or did not have the behavioral repertory, if you will, of the children in Mexico. They were distinguished by having been Americans all of their lives until going to Mexico. Those children were suffering an awful lot, and their sense of rupture from the U.S., this sense of territorial belonging and citizenship was eroding. And the older children, the teenagers, could anticipate that one day they would return to the U.S. to go to college. The younger kids saw that future at a greater distance, obviously, and they were perhaps the most impacted. The children who were left behind, as we called them, orphans, what they missed were their parents. The daily ministrations that parents give their children, putting them to bed, teaching them right from wrong, giving them valuable life lessons within an atmosphere of love and attention and affection and family unity, that was missing in these kids' lives. So their fear was the sense of loss of their parents, and that they didn't quite know what was happening to their parents. Sure, some of them were able to speak by phone to their parents, email and text, and even get on things like Skype, but the children were simply not able to know what was happening in their parents' lives in the way they could if they were physically present. And so these children were suffering also a depression because of that separation. And the third group, the ones that I say were under no deportation proceedings, we saw a lot of potential or actual separation anxiety. Those kids were afraid that, will mom or dad get home from work today? Will I see them? Or will they be picked up by the police, detained, and deported?
So conditions for immigrants today are quite tense, to say the least. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, has been in the news quite a bit lately. And its fate is currently in limbo because of recent decisions made by the Trump administration. Now, we're not just talking about kids, but teenagers and young adults. What is your feeling about the DACA cohort, and how does your work help us understand some of what they're feeling?
Well, the DACA children or youth are really the children that I would have studied had they been younger. And they present us with a unique perspective. These are children, young people who have grown up in this country as Americans and have felt as Americans until they discovered that they were not U.S. citizens. Some of that happened when they were young and their parents told them, or many of them found out when they were applying for their first driver's license, or when they wanted to go to college and their parents said, we've got something to tell you.
Yeah.
And that's been a very difficult situation for them, of course. I admire the fact that they are speaking up, they are banding together, they are making themselves known. But it doesn't take away the fact that many of them worry about themselves, worry about their parents, because if they're undocumented, chances are their parents are undocumented, but many of their younger siblings are U.S. citizens. So we're talking about mixed status families of a more complex form, because you've got the undocumented parents, you've got the undocumented but DACA eligible youth, and then you've got the younger U.S. citizen siblings. And what will happen? Those DACA youth are in between worrying about their parents, worrying about themselves, and worrying about their little brothers and sisters. So their situation is made worse by the current atmosphere, which is leaving them in, actually at this point, suspended as to what's going to happen, but fearful that the worst could come about.
Right. And so, you know, if you go by the discourse, the political discourse anyway, you know, and even then, the way that it gets flattened out, you're either legal or you're not, basically. But with the type of people we're talking about, they have very intense ties that cut across all of these legal boundaries, right?
That's correct. They're no different from you or me, except that they don't have the papers. Right. That's simple as that. They share the same passions that you and I might have for football and baseball and hot dogs and hamburgers and things like that, except that they're not citizens. And by all other measures, they are Americans.
Okay, so, I mean, in our first interview, I had you discuss the case of a six-year-old girl exhibiting signs of, as you called it, selective mutism. I'd like to revisit that because I think it's important to convey how this kind of stress can show up in the life of a young person. And can you share some of that story again, or other examples of how this stress can be so debilitating in certain cases?
Sure, sure. The case, we'll call her Virginia, as I call her in the book, and it was perhaps the most dramatic case of what can happen to a child who lives under this cloud of the parents' deportability. And it was a case of a little girl in which I was called by the attorneys who were challenging the father's deportation order, what they call a cancellation of removal case. They wanted to cancel the order of removal. And they called me in to evaluate the children, particularly this little girl, because she was the youngest in the family. And so I went about doing arranging for a typical psychological evaluation. However, the girl, little Virginia, would not talk. Not that she couldn't speak. She had no language or speech impairment whatsoever. She had she would speak at home. She would not speak in public settings, such as school and at stores or places like that. She would not speak. And for over 18 months in pre-K and K, the teachers told me of Virginia not speaking. Occasionally, she would whisper to one of her friends, their classmates, or they would interpret Virginia's behavior for the teacher. They would say, "I think Virginia has to go to the bathroom," or "I think Virginia means to say this." So she communicated with other children through whatever means.
Yeah,
that is a case of selective mutism, which is a diagnostic category of children who are able to speak, but for one reason or other choose not to. And the case was so striking because Virginia had been told all her life, "Be careful what you say about mom or dad. Don't talk about us because we might be uncovered as undocumented." Little Virginia, hearing that well before I met her, was very obedient. She did what her parents told her, be quiet. And she embodied what it's like for a child that has to be quiet, that she stopped speaking. She stopped speaking because she was afraid that through omission or commission, she might say something that would endanger her parents. And so she internalized that rule to the point of not speaking at all. And that's a dramatic case. Not all of the cases I have evaluated or have studied have that kind of impact, but we see it in other ways. Sleep disorders, night terrors, regression of behaviors to an earlier state, withdrawal and depression and things like that that have to do with being the child of an undocumented immigrant and the fear that you'll lose your mom or your dad. It's just that Virginia had embodied everything that we think about when we think about the children of undocumented immigrants and the lives that they must live.
Right. And even something like selective mutism, I mean, it kind of shows up in a typical clinical setting as a deficit. But I think it's important to underline how it's really an adaptation, perhaps even at times strategically effective for that person in that situation.
You're absolutely right, Ike. It was an adaptation. This was Virginia making sure that she didn't do any damage to her parents' situation. So yes, she adapted. She just kept quiet. It was adaptive in one way. It was not adaptive because in school we need to speak.
Right.
We need to communicate. That's the basis of a teacher's being able to judge how well we're doing on our alphabet or our words or our colors, especially in the early grades. And so that's where it was not adaptive. But in fact, you're right. Psychologically, Virginia was doing what she thought was right.
So in your view, what are behavioral health professionals called upon to do now? I mean, not that they're all necessarily ready to carry the mantle as activists in this space. But, I mean, in what ways can people in other sectors make a difference?
We can, there's a lot that behavioral health providers can and others can do for children, U.S. citizen children or their undocumented siblings, whether they're old enough to be DACA enrollees or not. The best we can do is provide families guidance on how to inform their child, when to inform their child about their status, the parents' own status and the children's status. We can help the child process any traumatic or stressful event that goes along with being the child of an undocumented immigrant. So they might have to learn to understand why it is that their parents are always so vigilant when they're on the roads for a police officer. Yeah. Or before they go out, they test all the lights and make sure everything is operating properly in the car so that they don't get pulled over. The children become aware of this, and they too absorb the parents' anxiety. So there are things that behavioral health providers can do. One of the most recent things that has been helpful to families, and it's been mentioned in some of the press, is the idea that we need to help families develop safety plans. Giving your children instructions, sometimes written instruction, as to what they should do in the event that mom or dad or both of us are detained. Perhaps keeping an envelope with instructions, with phone numbers of neighbors and friends and family that they can call, maybe some cash, $50, $100 with instructions. Make sure your brother's fed this and that or the other. And this is what you do in case we don't return. These kind of safety plans that are necessary. We need to think about helping families, and this involves lawyers, that is with powers of attorney that allow someone to take over those children who can act on behalf of the child should the parents be detained. And it's important that the person who is being empowered with these children for custody or guardianship needs to be a U.S. citizen, because to pass it on to yet another undocumented person will continue the jeopardy that the children are in. So those are the things that many of us can do. There's a lot that is that can be done also therapeutically, preventively, and after the child has experienced the trauma or the continued stress of the potential deportation.
Okay, so a minute ago you alluded to a book that you wrote. You want to tell us a little bit more about that and also how people can get a hold of it?
Ike, the title of the book that I published in 2015 is Forgotten Citizens: Deportation, Children, and the Making of American Exiles and Orphans, published by Oxford University Press. In that book, I describe my research, my clinical practice. I describe from actual experience with these families, with undocumented or mixed status families, I should say, what it's like to grow up being the child of an undocumented immigrant. And the book is intended for a general audience. It was not intended to be written for a professional or a scientific audience. It's available through Oxford University or Amazon. It can give your listeners a full perspective on what it's like. I cite cases, I describe legal cases as well as clinical cases and our research on this very vulnerable group of children in American society.
Okay, so this is a story about stress. It is also, I think, a story about resilience. So Dr. Louise Zayas, thank you so much for taking the time to help us better understand how it is both of those things. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ike. It's my pleasure to be here, and I want to commend the Hogg Foundation for this podcast, because it does give a chance for your public, your listeners, to learn more about what we can all do to help those most vulnerable. Thank you.
And that does it for this episode of Into the Fold. If you're interested in learning more about our new strategy at the Foundation, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. And if you'd like to listen to our first interview with Louise Zayas in 2015, it's episode 13, titled Deportation Threat and the Children of the Undocumented, which you can find on SoundCloud, on iTunes, or by searching for Into the Fold: Issues in Mental Health. And to ensure you don't miss any of our episodes, please sign up for podcast emails on our website. Thanks so much for joining us.